T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
It's Sunday, February 17th. I'm Margaret Brennan, and this is Face the Nation. Congress makes a deal to keep the government open, but wall funding falls short of the president's request.
The answer is no. I'm not. I'm not happy.
Firing back, President Trump declared a national security crisis at the border to access money to build a wall, brushing off critics who say it's unconstitutional.
Or so it gave the presidents the power. There's rarely been a problem. They sign it. Nobody cares.
But that's not so. In this case, Democrats and some Republicans are trying to stop the president. Delaware Democratic Senator Chris Coons and Texas Republican Congressman Will Hurd will weigh in. Plus, the stunning 60 Minutes interview with former acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe and his charge that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein brought up the possibility of invoking the 25th Amendment against President Trump. We asked the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Lindsey Graham, about it.
The underlying accusation is beyond stunning.
All this and analysis on the news of the week is just ahead on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. We have a lot to get to today, and we're going to begin with Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham. He joins us from Germany, where he is attending the Munich Security Conference. Sir, I want to get right to this conversation my colleague Scott Pelley had on 60 Minutes with former acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe, where he described a conversation about the 25th Amendment, the mechanism through which to push the president out of office. And he said it was brought up to him by the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein.
A discussion of the 25th Amendment was simply Rod raised the issue and discussed it with me in the context of thinking about how many other cabinet officials might support such an effort.
Rosenstein was actually openly talking about whether there was a majority of the cabinet who would vote to remove the president.
That's correct. Counting votes or possible votes.
What seemed to be coursing through the mind of the Deputy Attorney General was getting rid of the President of the United States.
Well,
one way or another.
I can't confirm that. But what I can say is the Deputy Attorney General was definitely very concerned about the president, about his capacity, and about his intent at that point in time.
How did he bring up the idea of the 25th Amendment to you?
Honestly, I don't remember. It was just another kind of topic that he jumped to in the midst of a wide-ranging conversation.
Seriously? Just another topic?
Yeah.
Senator, that's a tremendous allegation to make. Have you ever asked Rod Rosenstein if, in fact, that conversation happened?
Well, he's publicly denied it, but the whole point of Congress existing is to provide oversight of the executive branch. So through good reporting by 60 Minutes, there's an allegation by the acting FBI director at the time that the deputy attorney general was basically trying to do an administrative coup, take the president down through the 25th Amendment process. The deputy attorney general denies it. So I promise your viewers the following, that we will have a hearing about who's telling the truth, what actually happened. Mr. Cabe, you remember, was dismissed from the FBI for leaking information to the press. So you got to remember the source here.
There's been some parsing, though, of whether these were extended discussions versus conversations about the 25th Amendment.
Yeah. Right.
Do you know whether those conversations have taken place?
No, but I think everybody in the country needs to know if it happened. It's stunning to me that one of the chief law enforcement officers of the land, the acting head of the FBI, would go on national television and say, oh, by the way, I remember a conversation with the deputy attorney general about trying to find if we could replace the president under the 25th Amendment. We're a democracy. People enforce the law, can't take it in their own hands. And was this an attempted bureaucratic coup? I don't know. I don't know who's telling the truth. I know Rosenstein's vehemently denied it, but we're going to get to the bottom of it. I do know there was a lot of monkey business about FISA warrants being issued against Carter Page, about dossiers coming from Russia that were unverified. Mr. Mueller is going to look at the Trump campaign, as he should, to see if they violated any laws during the 2016 election. And I'm going to do everything I can to get to the bottom of the Department of Justice, FBI behavior toward President Trump and his campaign.
But by even framing it as you just did there, Senator, are you concerned that by investigating the investigators, you are adding to some damage of the credibility of the FBI?
Quite the opposite. If it happened, we need to clean it up. The FBI has gotten off track in the past. It's one of the greatest organizations in the world. The Hoover years have proven to be pretty dark periods for the FBI, the latter part of the Hoover days where politicians were being blackmailed. There's no organization beyond scrutiny. There's no organization that can't withstand scrutiny. And the FBI will come out stronger. But we got to get to the bottom of it. What are people to think after they watch 60 Minutes when they hear this accusation by the acting FBI director that the deputy attorney general encouraged him to try to find ways to count votes to replace the president? That can't go unaddressed, and it will be addressed. That's what oversight is all about.
Will you subpoena McCabe and Rosenstein to appear?
How can I not, if that's what it takes? I mean, you're doing your job. The First Amendment allows you to ask questions of the most powerful people in the country. I know he's selling a book, and we need to take with a grain of salt maybe what Mr. McCabe is telling us. But he went on national television and made an accusation that floors me. You know, I can imagine if the shoe were on the other foot, we're talking about getting rid of President Clinton, it'd be front page news all over the world. Well, we're going to find out what happened here, and the only way I know to find out is to call the people in under oath and find out, you know, through questioning, who's telling the truth, because the underlying accusation is beyond stunning.
I want to play another clip from that interview for you.
What was it specifically that caused you to launch the counterintelligence investigation?
It's many of those same concerns that cause us to be concerned about a national security threat. And the idea is, if the president committed obstruction of justice, fired the director of the FBI to negatively impact or to shut down our investigation of Russia's malign activity and possibly in support of his campaign, as a counterintelligence investigator, you have to ask yourself, why would a president of the United States do that? So all those same sorts of facts cause us to wonder, is there an inappropriate relationship, a connection between this president and our most fearsome enemy, the government of Russia?
Senator, you voiced support for the Mueller probe in the past. Listening to what McCabe just described there, a troubling pattern of behavior that he, as a lifetime investigator, saw as a troubling fact pattern, led him to open a counterintelligence investigation into the president of the United States. Can you understand why he came to that conclusion?
I can understand that the American people will get an answer to the question from Mr. Mueller. What I can understand is why Mr. McCabe would meet with Page and Strzok to discuss their hatred for President candidate Trump, talking about taking an insurance policy out in case the election went different than they want. So Mueller will tell us about what Trump did or didn't do. I'm going to tell the country about McCabe and the people at the Department of Justice and how they behaved. Did they take the law in their own hands? Did they abuse the FISA warrant process because they had a political agenda? Did their hatred of Trump go so far that they abandoned their role of being law enforcement agents and become advocates for a political cause? We're going to get to the bottom of that.
But you recognize there that McCabe is laying out the grounds of what he saw as an obstruction of justice attempt.
Mr. Mueller will look at that, but I think McCabe, Strzok, and Page had a political bias, a political agenda. And I find it odd that the dossier that we used to get the warrant against Carter Page, prepared by a foreign agent paid for by the Democratic Party, that they knew to be unreliable, was used on four separate occasions to get a warrant. And I want to know why Comey told the president, here's a dossier, we've got it, we can't verify any of it, we want you to know about it. And that same document was used by the FBI and the Department of Justice under oath to tell the court, this is reliable information, give us a warrant based on this document. I hope your viewers understand that the rule of law works both ways. Somebody's got to watch those who watch us. And I intend to watch what McCabe and his crowd did during the 2016 election.
The president just declared a national emergency in regard to getting the funds for his border wall. In terms of getting those funds, though, through this emergency action, there's about $3.6 billion of it that could come from military construction efforts, including construction of a middle school in Kentucky, housing for military families, improvements for bases like Camp Pendleton and Hanscom Air Force Base. Aren't you concerned that some of these projects that were part of legislation that you helped approve in Congress are now going to possibly be cut out?
Well, the president will have to make a decision where to get the money. Let's just say for a moment that he took some money out of the military construction budget. I would say it's better for the middle school kids in Kentucky to have a secure border. We'll get them the school they need. But right now, we got a national emergency on our hands. Opioid addiction is going through the roof in this country. Thousands of Americans died last year and dying this year because we can't control the flow of drugs into this country, and all of it's coming across the border. So
through
the dangers presented by a broken border,
to Customs and Border Patrol, though. But
both. It's both. It's not just one. For every one we get, God knows how much we miss.
Don't you think Congress has ceded too much power to the executive branch? Do you think that you need to more sharply define what constitutes a national emergency so that future presidents can't interpret it as they like?
Good question. I think that every member of Congress has watched three presidents send troops to the border. Bush, Obama, now Trump. Not one of us have complained about deploying forces to the border to secure the border. It's pretty hard for me to understand the legal difference between sending troops and having them build a barrier. What disappoints me is on President Obama's watch, as a Republican, I voted for a $44 billion border security package, $9 billion of which included barriers. 2006, all of us voted for the Secure Fence Act, and we're talking about steel barriers, not a concrete wall. And unfortunately, when it comes to Trump, the Congress is locked down and will not give him what we've given past presidents. So unfortunately, he's got to do it on his own, and I support his decision to go that route.
Well, perhaps in the future we can talk about sharpening what constitutes an emergency. But before I let you go, you made a pitch from the stage there at Munich for foreign troops to be committed to Syria alongside American forces. How many U.S. forces are needed to stay there, and has President Trump actually made that commitment to you?
Well, this thank you for asking, Margaret. The Islamic State in Iraq and Syria has been destroyed. It has been defeated. All the work is not yet done. Remnants of ISIS are lethal. We need a follow-on presence post-caliphate destruction. The good news, we can do this with a fraction of American forces we've had in Syria in the past. The real good news is Europeans are willing to contribute because their cities have been attacked from Syria. The caliphate in Syria has caused thousands of deaths inside of Europe. I think just a fraction, a couple of hundred compared to 2,700, would be enough to get Europeans to contribute to the stabilizing force to make sure ISIS doesn't come back like it did in Iraq, to make sure that Turkey and the Kurds don't go to war, to keep them apart, and to make sure Iran doesn't come in and take over when we leave. So I've never felt better about the outcome in Syria. With a small contingent of Americans, a lot of Europeans will come in and help fill in the gap. A very small down payment to secure ISIS never comes back. We've gone from thousands of troops in Iraq and Syria down now to a couple of hundred in Syria. Congratulations, Mr. President. The job is not yet done, but we've done a hell of a job destroying the caliphate.
Senator Graham, thank you. We want to turn now to another attendee at the Munich Security Conference, Delaware Democrat Chris Coons. You now have heard the former acting FBI director come public after leaving office about what he saw as grounds for discussion of the 25th Amendment. What do you think of making those details public now?
Well, Margaret, as you heard from Senator Graham, this will almost certainly be taken up by the Senate Judiciary Committee. But what's striking to me about this conference and, frankly, around the world is the way in which President Trump's abrupt decision to withdraw from Syria has really unsettled our core allies, because he did so without consulting with any of our allies. A candidate Donald Trump ran as someone who would be unconventional, who would break the mold and be unpredictable, and he has certainly overperformed in that category. But what is striking to me about the 60 Minutes reporting about the conversations that are alleged to have happened at the highest levels of our law enforcement community is that folks who were career professionals were troubled enough by what they saw in terms of President Trump's actions with regard to Russia that they felt compelled to open a counterintelligence investigation. I think that should give all of us pause.
McCabe himself has been questioned in terms of his own personal behavior. He was fired after an IG investigation found that he lied or lacked candor four times under oath. So do you question the credibility of his claims?
Look, the most important thing in my mind is that Robert Mueller be able to complete his investigation without interference. If we also need to have some sunshine, some disinfectant here about everything that led to the beginning and the pursuit of that investigation, that strikes me as appropriate.
So to be clear, when your colleague Senator Graham was talking about wanting to, on the Judiciary Committee, investigate things like abuse of foreign surveillance and the grounds under which warrants were obtained, you support all of that?
My hope is that Chairman Graham will be open to calling a number of witnesses who, based on previous testimony, also need to come in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. We should not be pursuing just one theory or one line of investigation here. We should be looking at all the matters that are appropriate for oversight by the Senate Judiciary Committee.
From what you heard from McCabe himself, the pattern he was describing, is that an appropriate response or an appropriate potential use of the 25th Amendment?
Well, I can't speak to that, having not heard the entire interview. It is alarming that there were apparently folks at the highest levels of our government considering whether or not our president is unfit to serve. I don't think that this, frankly, rises to the level of some deep state conspiracy or a serious attempt at what Senator Graham called an administrative coup. I suspect that once this is fully discussed, it'll be clear that this was a brief or passing conversation that's been taken out of context, but it does deserve scrutiny.
Do you think there should be a joint resolution, an attempt by Congress to stop the president from going forward with this emergency declaration?
Well, given that what President Trump is trying to do, to build a big wall between the United States and Mexico to meet a campaign promise, something that Congress considered and rejected, that the president wasn't able to secure over 2 years when Republicans controlled the Congress. I do think, Margaret, we should take action to disapprove of this excessive use of executive power and make it clear that the Article I branch, the Congress, is going to jealously defend our right to be the body that decides on federal spending and not let the president use this extreme measure as an end around our appropriations process.
If you do see a Democratic president in that office, would you share the concern? Do you think Congress now needs to put some restrictions on the executive's ability to declare a national emergency?
I do think that we should not set the terrible precedent of letting a president declare a national emergency simply as a way of getting around the congressional appropriation process. Presidents do have emergency powers. They can declare national emergencies. But if you look back at the history of that over the last four decades, they've overwhelmingly been done in the face of legitimate national security threats where there was no time or no other means of addressing them.
I want to ask you about a foreign policy issue as well. And you brought it up at the beginning of our conversation, and that's Syria. Senator Graham just made a pitch to our allies to commit boots, troops to Syria and promised that U.S. troops would stay alongside them. What do you make of that pitch?
Well, this is where Senator Graham and I agree. And the delegation in the meetings that I've been in has been speaking up with one voice, saying that an abrupt and total withdrawal of all American forces from Syria would have a terrible consequence of handing our allies in the fight against ISIS, the Kurds, over either to Iran or to the Turks, and that we should be working in partnership with our allies to make sure that we don't allow ISIS to reemerge and that we don't allow Iran and Russia to dominate Syria. I'll join Senator Graham in congratulating the president and our armed forces in ending the ISIS caliphate. But I think for us to pull all of our forces, literally every American soldier, out of Syria would be disastrous.
So how many should
stay? Would have consequences, not just for Syria's security, but for our allies.
How many should stay then?
At most, a few hundred to secure both the Al-Tanf base that is blocking Iran from having a highway right into and across Syria, and to secure a buffer zone between our Kurdish partners in the fight against ISIS and the Turks.
All right. Senator Coons, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret.
Texas Republican Congressman Will Hurd. He joins us from his district in San Antonio this morning. Congressman, you are directly impacted by anything at the border since about 800 miles of it are in your home district. How is this emergency declaration going to impact your constituents?
Well, I have 820 miles of the border. I'm the only Republican that represents a border town. And I spent almost a decade as an undercover officer in the CIA chasing bad guys all over the world. How is this going to impact my district? First and foremost, I don't think we needed a national emergency declaration. That is not a tool that the president needs in order to solve this problem. This is a problem that has existed before Ronald Reagan. And what we need to be doing is remember, we just passed a piece of legislation that adds more technology, that has physical barriers in order to solve this problem. And I was just down on the border. I was in the Del Rio sector. The border is broken up into sectors. I was specifically in the city of Eagle Pass. And then I crossed the border into Mexico, into Piedras Negras. They are dealing with a recent caravan. And guess what? There was unprecedented cooperation between the U.S. government and the Mexican government. We have to remember that most of the people that are coming here illegally are coming from Central America. They're not Mexican citizens. In this one sector I visited, 92% of the people that are coming there illegally are from Central America, and 80% of that is specifically from Honduras. So this is a shared problem with us and Mexico. And in this new administration in Mexico, we've seen this level of cooperation to deal with this shared problem. We need to address things like Border Patrol pay. Mm-hmm. There's a reason that, you know, Border Patrol has a retention problem. We don't have enough Border Patrol officers. We need additional technology. Everybody thinks that there's the latest and greatest technology along the border. It doesn't. This bill we passed this Friday, that got signed into law, has a program called the Innovative Tower Initiative, which is what I describe as the smart wall and uses technology to figure out what's going
right.
back and forth across our border.
What about
this executive?
But what about the private property that is going to be seized to build the wall that the president is saying he's going to do? That must impact your constituents.
Oh, absolutely. In the great state of Texas, we care about a little thing called private property. And there's going to be over 1,000 ranchers and farmers potentially impacted if the government comes in and takes their land. And listen how they do it. They say, hey, we need this land. Here's what we're going to give you. And they get to automatically take it. And then the rancher or the landowner has to go in and fight in court to make sure that they're at a minimum getting what they owed because of the price of the land. In some places, in a part where the wall is being designed or they think they want to build the wall, we're going to be ceding 1.1 million acres of arable land.
That's tremendous. It's
crazy.
We were talking about how your home district is going to be impacted by this emergency declaration. Today, White House senior advisor Stephen Miller told Fox News' Chris Wallace that the White House has the authorities to build a couple hundred miles by the end of the next appropriations cycle, which is September 2020. You sit on House Appropriations. Can Congress or the courts stop the administration from getting the money to do this?
Well, what this national emergency declaration does is it says the president is going to obligate funds, so he's going to take funds from other places, but you can't spend $8 billion in the next 6 months. And so what I think you're going to see in the next appropriation cycle is restricting some of that funds. And then the question you have is when it comes to military construction, right? Can you take funds from that was going to be used to constructing things in the military? And you outlined a couple of items earlier in this segment. But how about the fact that in my district, in Del Rio, Texas, this produces more pilots than any other facility in the United States of America. If it rains more than an inch, the flight line gets flooded and they can't train. We've been working on fixing that. We're trying to get more additional funds. If you're going to reprogram money, that's a good place to spend that kind of money rather than trying to build a wall. And we have to remember, there's already 654 miles of wall or barrier or whatever you want to call it, steel fencing. The president has already been authorized over $55 million in this last appropriation bill. He was able to reauthorize $750 million within Homeland Security. My concern is our government wasn't designed to operate by national emergency. Unfortunately, a Congress that existed before I was born usurped some of their power, gave some of their power away to the executive branch. Our government was designed for the most ultimate power, the power of the purse, to reside within Congress, and we shouldn't have an executive, I don't care if it's Republican or Democrat, that tries to get around Congress with this national emergency declaration.
So would you support a resolution to try to stop the president from doing that?
I would support something that reviews who can, how you declare a national emergency. I would support something that prevents, that actually is going to prevent taking money out of military construction. That's going to go to our men and women who are willing to put on a uniform, put themselves in harm's way, and they need to make sure that we have the tools that they're properly trained and they're properly equipped to do things. So I'm always open to making sure that Congress takes back some of its power as a co-equal branch of government. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of conversations. We're almost in uncharted territory because I think, based on my research, this is one of the first times that there's been a disagreement between the executive branch and Congress on what is indeed a national emergency. It sets a dangerous precedent, but there will be a lot of people focusing on this over the next couple of weeks.
So to be clear, you are saying that this wall that you don't think the United States needs on national security grounds will actually adversely impact national security because it will hurt the readiness of some of these military bases in your district?
If you're taking money away from the military, we just spent the last 4 years rebuilding our military, making sure the men and women in our armed forces have the tools that they need. I don't want to see that money being taken away from that. We went through a number of hearings and investigations in order to figure out where that money needs to go. And so that is how our government is supposed to operate.
And yes, you're confident that Congress can stop that money from being raided from those military construction funds, the $3.6 billion?
I would say that people are going to be exploring how that can ultimately be done because we're in uncharted territory. But I want to also make it clear that $67 billion worth of drugs are coming into our country. 400,000 people came to our country illegally last year. We have a problem at our border. We don't have what I call operational control of our border, meaning we know everything that's going back and forth across our border. So this is a problem. Mm-hmm. And the only way we solve the problem is looking at all 2,000 miles of our southern border at the same time. And the only way you can do that is with manpower and technology. In some places, a physical barrier makes sense where there's urban-urban contact. Again, we already have 654 miles of physical barrier. So we got to be thinking about the strategy, not a focus on just one tool within that strategy.
Congressman, thank you very much for joining us this Sunday. We're going to bring in our panel now for some political analysis. David Nakamura covers the White House for The Washington Post. Rachel Bade covers Congress, and she has just moved over to The Washington Post. She's also a CNN political analyst. We want to welcome Eugene Scott to this broadcast. He's also with The Washington Post. And Leslie Sanchez is a CBS News contributor and a very familiar face to our viewers who tune in to CBSN, our digital network. Leslie, let me start with you. You heard the president lay out his case for this emergency. New York Times, though, in terms of writing about the fallout, said it was the most punishing defeat Mr. Trump has experienced as a president. Do you agree?
I don't think Republicans are going to agree on that. What's interesting, I was speaking to a lot of the legislative leaders and business leaders along the Texas-Mexico border, and they feel this is not a real solution, but a political one. But if you look at the fact that there's a tremendous amount of baseline support to secure the border, where the president does not have the support, is over 60%, according to what Gallup has been looking at, some other research, don't support the idea of a physical wall. So when it's parsing those words. I think, Margaret, if he can show he is securing with both technology, technical infrastructure, human capital, you know, all the things that border enforcement is saying they need, then I think he's going to get a legislative win on that. However, if it just looks like a contiguous border, he's not. And I do want to point out the fact the president has walked that back. Mm-hmm. He was on numerous occasions saying, why does the wall go the entire 2,000-mile border? But that's not the reality. So for that, with that extent and that in mind, I think we're making progress.
Can I just follow up on, you know, your mention that this is a political solution. Republicans on the Hill feel the same way, and they're very annoyed in some cases that they're being sort of unwittingly dragged into the president's 2020 reelection effort. You know, the president feels the Trump and that declaring this emergency is going to help his own reelection. But this is dividing lawmakers. And you just saw that with your interviews right there with Will Hurd saying this was a bad idea, that he could see constituents have their land seized and that it would be taking money from the military, with people like Lindsey Graham saying, oh, you know, this is going to secure our country. And so right now it's really dividing the party.
Just real quick on that part. And also in the conference, there was a big point of saying, not only with Congressman Hurd, but a Congressman Henry Cuellar, who was also on the board of the Democrat, saying we want topography, the local law, you know, leaders to be involved in the discussion, because you don't want to be building, you know, eminent domain on right. people's lands, the issues of livestock and using the Rio Grande for other purposes. So there's a lot of disagreement on how that's done. But now that the president is backpedaling on how you secure the border, I think there can be a positive.
I would add one thing, was whether this is a win or a loss for the president. I mean, the president wants to be seen as the ultimate winner here, but just look at his news conference in announcing this. It took him about 5 minutes to even get to the idea that he was declaring a national emergency. He was acknowledging it was probably going to be stopped in court. He didn't act like a winner in sort of announcing this in the Rose Garden the way he did. He took questions on a lot of other topics, which is fine. We want to hear him make news. But if he really believed in what he was doing here, believed this was a really, truly winning strategy, I think you would have seen a much more determinative announcement in the way that he rolled that out.
But one of the reasons I believe that the president was not able to communicate the national emergency in a winsome way is because it's not winsome. It's widely unpopular with many people outside of his base, which is where the majority of voters are. We know that this is an approach that is popular with Republicans who back Trump, but we know that he won because so many independents came over to support him, and he needs those votes as well if he's going to do well in 2020. And recent polling, especially after the midterm, shows that he's not doing well with those voters.
Rachel, I want to ask you about the other news we have here from that tremendous interview with 60 Minutes and Andrew McCabe. Look, McCabe's gone. Jim Comey is gone. There is a new Attorney General, Bill Barr, who's now on the job, and Senator Lindsey Graham is now in the chairmanship of the Judiciary Committee. So where does all of this head next?
That story is not over. McCabe may be gone. Rosenstein is heading toward the exits. But this whole notion about this 25th Amendment and whether there was actually a conversation to try to oust the president or see if there was support to oust the president, Republicans are going to continue in that vein. And it's interesting from this interview, it looks like Lindsey Graham, as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, is going to pick up right where House Republicans left off when they lost the majority and Democrats took over. You know, before the past 2 years, Republicans in the House, they've sort of been doing this investigate the investigator, sort of an inquiry about whether there's bias at the FBI or the Justice Department. That has gone away. They've lost their subpoena power. And Graham is showing that he's not only going to pick that up, he potentially is going to go even further by telling you that he is willing to subpoena Rosenstein and bring in McCabe to actually ask him what happened with these conversations.
And where does that fit in, Eugene, to the political strategy here in terms of laying the groundwork for the Mueller report?
Well, I would imagine that in part it is to keep people questioning Mueller and the bias that the president believes exists within the FBI that's working against him. It's the whole witch hunt idea just taken to the next step, trying to put some meat on those bones and looking at people like Lindsey Graham to be able to do that and argue that the president's suspicions are credible and they're not irrational. Whether or not they're actually going to be able to do that, people are still waiting to see. But what we do know is that most Americans, according to polling we have in The Washington Post, want to see this investigation continue because they do believe that Mueller is more likely to be credible than the president himself.
David, switching gears here, we heard overnight that Heather Nauert, who had been at the State Department as an undersecretary and as a spokesperson there, is withdrawing her name from consideration to be the next UN ambassador. What happened? Why did she do that?
What we understand is that her nomination was languishing in part because her own team had not even forwarded all their necessary paperwork to the Senate committee that would have to do her oversight hearing. And I think the reason now we're finding out is that she actually employed a nanny who was in the country legally from another country, but had not been necessarily had a work permit to work here legally. Taxes were not being paid on time. Nauert had apparently flagged this internally, but it's become something of an issue of this potentially being a problem and a disqualifying a measure, something that would be embarrassing not only to her family, but also could stand in the way from the Senate moving forward. This is a blow to the administration, though, because she's certainly someone I think that the president had grown to trust in her role as a spokeswoman at the State Department. And he'd had his own, President Trump had his own problems with the previous UN Secretary Nikki Haley in some cases. Mm-hmm. And he believes this would be someone who would be very loyal to him. But they now seem to be making the decision to move on.
Leslie, is it disqualifying?
For some it is, and for some it's not. It just reminds me of the 1993 Nannygate, when you had the revelations, you know, that Bill Clinton was trying to nominate not one, but two attorney generals that both had issues with nannies who were undocumented. But in more recent history, under Bill Clinton, and even if you think about under Trump, Wilbur Ross, who had undocumented, perhaps they didn't pay taxes on people that worked domestically in their household, they managed to get through. So they're threading that needle. I think it's changed a lot in that conversation. But again, going back to our first topic, it becomes an issue of labor and undocumented individuals working in these households and not paying taxes.
But Rachel, you know, some have put this in the context of the president has had this happen with a few different nominees, or at least people he said he's going to nominate. Is the White House really setting up their selections for success? The president's tweeting this morning blaming Democrats for stalling his ambassadors from being confirmed.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's just a way to sort of shift the narrative and try to point the finger. I mean, there's been complaints, including by some Republicans on the Hill. The White House does not do enough to vet people before they actually put them forward. And so, yeah, this has been an issue. I mean, Mick Mulvaney, now the acting chief of staff, he had his own issue with not paying taxes for, again, I believe it was a nanny. So, again, it's an embarrassment for the administration. And Republicans would like to see them button that up before they actually move people forward.
And it comes on the heels of all this reporting in the Washington Post and other places, the New York Times, about the president's own employment of undocumented workers at his golf club for years, at a time that he was running for president and railing on the use of undocumented immigrants, now declaring this a national emergency. So this would have fed into all sorts of other questions that Congress and certainly Democratic lawmakers will want to ask.
Eugene, we had two of our senators as guests from Munich, from the security conference, and there's been a lot said about the importance or the statement being made to have such a big congressional delegation at what is a conference built around celebrating alliances, mm-hmm. something that the administration is often criticized for not valuing enough. You had former Vice President Biden there, you know, the current Vice President Mike Pence there. What was the reaction like in terms of Pence's message to the room?
Well, for the most part, it was silent. There was a lack of confidence in the message that Mike Pence was delivering, suggesting that the America First mindset that the president has been campaigning on and leading since entering the Oval Office is of the best interest for the world as a whole. On multiple occasions, lines that he's used to receiving applause and taking breaks for were met with silence, in part because we know that many of our European allies do not see the United States as any longer a world leader when it comes to security issues and boldly disagree with much of what the president has put forward. And it's telling to see how surprised Pence himself was that he wasn't met with the same type of support that he usually is met with when he's making these same statements on the campaign trail or within groups and here in the States that are used to supporting him and backing what the president believes to be in the best interest for the country and the world.
And David, in contrast to that, Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, was well received. Her remarks, it was noted, she said she doesn't understand how possibly her country could be called a national security threat when BMWs are made in the United States these days. You know, it was almost like a laugh line at the president's trade policies here and saying here that he's vacating space to Iran. Our closest allies are really at a distance.
Yeah, it's no surprise that Angela Merkel's been at odds with President Trump, but she seemed, in this case, to be unbound by any concerns about her own political future, given that she's probably not, as said, she won't pursue another term as chancellor. But think about this. I was just thinking about last September at the U.N. General Assembly in New York. President Trump came up and said he'd done more than any other president in 2 years. He got laughed at. He went to France and Paris for the 100th year anniversary of World War I. And Emmanuel Macron, the French president, came up and delivered a very pointed rebuke of nationalism and things that Trump has talked about, with Trump right there in the audience. And now Vice President Pence goes to this Munich Security Conference and basically is greeted with silence. I mean, what's worse, getting laughed at or having sort of radio silence? I'm not sure what's worse, but there continues to be this message, and Angela Merkel on her final sort of tour here in the next couple of years will be continuing to deliver this pointed rebuke of Trump.
I think that that's why you saw a lot of lawmakers joining at Munich this weekend, because they wanted to go there to reassure our allies that we are still on your side. I mean, former Vice President Joe Biden also gave this speech to the audience, talking about how when I travel around the country and I talk to Americans, Americans still see you guys as important to our national security, that we still want to be in NATO and we're not looking at leaving NATO. Even the president had talked about doing such a couple of weeks ago. So you're seeing this sort of bipartisan pushback on the president, including several votes in the House and the Senate, where they've actually rebuked the president's foreign policy. So we're just going to have to see, as time goes on, are more Republicans working with him on that to push back and sort of reclaim our standing in the world?
I think it's an important point, and we'll leave it there on that. Also interesting that Vice President Biden, former Vice President, was there. We haven't heard a lot from those who are expected to throw their hat into the ring for 2020 on national security, but he staked that out, at least for the weekend. Former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, who's here to talk about his new book, Beyond Charlottesville, Taking a Stand Against White Nationalism. It's out in July and looks at what led to the violent Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville and how Virginia and the country continue to deal with racism. Good to have you here. Certainly your state of Virginia continues to deal with racism. The governor, Northam, who we heard from last week, has refused to resign, despite near universal calls among elected Democrats to do so. Can he survive?
Yes, I think he's made the decision he's going to stand. But the way that Ralph survives and brings Virginia back together, he's got to lean in on these very important issues, which I talk about in the book. He's got to use executive authority as governor. You know, I used executive authority. I took the Confederate flag off the Virginia license plates. I banned the box on any state employment forms. And as you know, I restored the felon rights of 173,000 individuals, more than any governor in U.S. history. I was sued by the Republicans. We ultimately won. And the reason I was so adamant about doing that was because of Virginia's racial history. It goes back to the Jim Crow laws. In 1902, a state senator, disenfranchisement of felons, a poll tax, and a literacy test, to put it in our Constitution, and his quote that day is, "I'm doing this to eliminate the darkie from being a political factor in Virginia." Well, 114 years later, was new sheriff in town, and I was able to enfranchise all these people to give them a second chance. And this is what our leadership in Virginia needs to do. We need to lean in. We've had a horrible history. You look at Charlottesville, Margaret, I can't even say to you on TV what I heard that day against members of the African-American community and members of the Jewish faith. These people walking down the streets, you know, they used to wear hoods. They used to do it at night because they were embarrassed. They don't feel they have to wear hoods anymore, and they can do it in broad daylight. Something has gone wrong in our country. And I talk in the book about how we got to bring our country back together again. Mm-hmm. We got to deal with the issues of the past, but we need to go forward.
What about the Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, who faces sexual assault charges? Can he survive?
Very serious allegations have been made. They need to be investigated. He has called for an investigation. The two women have called for an investigation. I believe this week in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. they've opened up an investigation, and I believe the Duke University has opened up an investigation. So we will go through that process. What I'm hoping now is what has happened here that, you know, we're a great state, and I was very proud as governor. I eliminated all the horrible biases that we had. Remember when I came into office, the Republicans had wanted to shut all the women's clinics down. We had horrible legislation against women, the transvaginal bill, horrible legislation against members of the LGBT. We got rid of all that. We became open, welcoming. That's why we got Amazon. There was no question. You know, I put the bid in.
I want to ask you about that.
Yeah, that's why we got Amazon. You cannot succeed as a governor. You cannot grow your state unless you're perceived as open and welcoming to everyone.
Well, so New York, as you know, Amazon pulled out of New York after they had bid for this facility there. But some of the outcry locally and then nationally from progressives was saying this is a win against big corporations. This is a win for a little guy, the little guy. I mean, for you, what do you think the impact is? Does this in any way paint the Democratic Party as well as anti-business?
I certainly hope not. Listen, I put the bid in for Amazon in September 17 while I was governor. Before I put the bid in, I worked with my state legislators. I worked with all of the local communities in Northern Virginia and Richmond and Hampton Roads. So when our bid went in, everybody was all in. I cannot for the life of you understand after this bid went in why the locals came out against it. Why, you should have done the due diligence before you submitted the bid. It just doesn't make any sense. But more importantly, our bid, and we won, and we're going to create 25 up to 37,000 jobs in Virginia, high-paying jobs. You've got to build an economy for the future. I just read a report that artificial intelligence will eliminate 40% of the world's jobs in the next two decades. You better be creating new 21st century jobs. We welcome Amazon. Now, they don't get any money until they come in, create the jobs, and pay the taxes. It's all how you structure the deal. So if Jeff Bezos, if you're watching here, thank you for coming to Virginia. You don't want to go to New York? I would tell you, bring the other jobs to Virginia. We are an open, welcoming, dynamic state. We're the number one state for cyber, for data, for unmanned systems.
I've got to, before I let you go, though, ask you, March 31st, you set as your deadline to announce whether you're running for president. What are you waiting for? Is it Joe Biden?
I'm not. I have spoken with the vice president. I've made hundreds and hundreds of calls across the country. Talk to potential staff. And listen, we're close to make a decision. I want to see where the field is. I do think we need in this race a progressive governor who was very jobs oriented, very successful in economic development. Mm-hmm. They're not mutually exclusive. A governor is a CEO. We build roads. We fix roads. We do need governors in this race because, you know, we don't just get to talk all day. We got to deliver every single day.
Well, we'd love to have you back and talk about it when you're ready to make a decision, Governor. That's it for us today. Thank you all for watching. Until next week, for Face the Nation, I'm Margaret Brennan. Today's guests were South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, Delaware Democratic Senator Chris Coons, Republican Congressman Will Hurd of Texas, and former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. This broadcast was directed by Allison Hawley. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow the show and CBS News on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 11 a.m., 3 p.m., 6 p.m. Eastern.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.